This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Radio Free Radio. What's that? Precocious podcasters. No dusty console, no stuffy studio littered with the day's paper, a few notes scribbled on the back of a press release from the morning show, someone's red sweater. No overworked tech coordinator skulking in the hallway when the second CD player stops working, again. No phone calls from someone requesting a song or wanting to send you an article they think you might like. No live guests arriving barely on time and co-hosts barely holding it together before their morning coffee. Call me a hypocrite. Look, I'm podcasting. But it's a podcast about radio. About the experience of radio. Community radio. A podcast might be able to amplify more voices, more ideas, more content. But it can't reproduce what it's like going on air in a live studio, where you're the tech, the host, the producer, and your voice is going out over the airwaves into the homes of your friends, your neighbors, your fellow activists, random people you bump into at the market who said they caught your show. You put in hours at events handing out program guides, you attend general meetings, you fundraise for this crazy operation. God-awful experience that is. You learn how to write policy, procedures, to manage a station, to work with people that you have to see. Somehow that's different than this, and somehow that's what this podcast is trying to capture. This is Homebrew, community-crafted radio. Adventures in amateur media making that's reimagining what the hell that overused word community is in the first place. We get started with a story about a parade, a pirate, and some old Greek god called Prometheus, embodied in a guy named Pete.
How's the parade going, Pete?
Oh, it's beautiful here. There's about maybe 200 people, I'd guess. And there's a giant dragon. There's a giant antenna tower. There's a bunch of drummers you can hear in the background and lots of weird triangle-shaped head things. And so it's real exciting. It's a great first day for a radio station. Even though it looks like it could rain, there's like no rain coming down and making all of our cardboard wet, so what more could we ask for?
Have you guys had a parade to kick off a barn raising before, or to end off a barn raising before?
We never did. This was Margot's brilliant idea, and Kate is the one that put it together, even though she's never made a parade before. So it's a great addition, and I think we'll try to do one anytime we can.
I think that parade should happen as much as possible.
This is the production room.
Oh, so this is the Valley Free Radio Studio, WXOJ LP. The layout was, gone over, and it went through, I think, four or five iterations.
Main board there, CD racks over here.
There's a really long hallway outside of the space. We've set up tables all along one wall, and it looks like some sort of bunker where people are busily working on some sort of revolutionary product. There's computers down at one end, and there's people soldering in the middle, and there's people with consoles and wires streaming all over the place. And so it looks like this sort of mad scientist workshop in the hallway, which sort of typifies the barn raising, and that it's kind of a mad scientist project, and where you have people who wouldn't necessarily be able to have access to the technology or really the chance to work on things like a broadcast console. The people with no experience, we put them right in front.
I'm making an XLR cable.
The technology is not as complicated as many think.
So you start by stripping the wire?
There's no reason why someone can't learn how to solder and then make a bunch of cables, and they'll all work as long as you're attentive to the details and you have someone there that's maybe giving a little bit of guidance.
So you could even go less than a quarter of an inch.
We have 20 engineers at the barn raising who could build the whole station with their fingers, tied behind their backs, and they, just manipulating the gadgets with their teeth. But that's not the point. The point is to have the station built by people who don't do that, so that they can see how it works. You've seen a move towards homogenization of radio and with the clear channel model of putting a computer and a voice tracked DJ on the air, and it's just, it all is sounding the same. And what makes community radio and grassroots radio and low power FM different is the people behind it. People really have to open up and say, well, I don't know how to do this. I can ask these people and maybe I can teach them something about this other skill that I know. And so the people in the community aspect of it is really what is the important part of the barn.
13.
The technology is just a vehicle. And the skill sharing is just a vehicle. In the end, you've got a new radio station, you have a community of people that helped build it, and you have a community of people that are going to run it after we leave.
That was Andy Gunn, the technical coordinator of the Prometheus Radio Project. Valley Free Radio went on the air in Florence, Massachusetts, on the afternoon of Sunday, August 8th. It was the result of 5 years of organizing patients by local activists and various community members that wished to realize a more independent and diverse radio alternative themselves. More about that feat of community cooperation will wait for another podcast. This is a story about Prometheus Radio Project, the rather bohemian troupe of radio engineers and organizers that have helped 8 small communities across the United States obtain low-power FM licenses, and then provided the support to get them built. The final building phase is achieved through the tremendous collective efforts of a radio barn raising. The barn raising in Florence was my first, and you can be sure that I'll get to the next one if I can. I'd met Petri Dish, one of the founding members of Prometheus, previously at a radio event in Canada, but this was my first real chance to catch up with him at length, about how Prometheus came about, and about its pirate past. We sat up against a wall outside the Florence Community Center, which is where Valley Free Radio is now situated to have this conversation. It came at the end of the barn raising, and after a string of sleepless nights, putting the finishing touches on the station. I was lucky that Pete stayed awake long enough to share these stories with me.
I didn't know a lot about the FCC when I started a pirate radio station. I just knew that, you know, my small group couldn't get a radio license, and I was correct about that, and that Clear Channel could have 1,200, and that was just crazy. I first visited the FCC, I believe, early in 1998. It was in its old building, whereas before I'd been really afraid of them, but defiant, you know, and, you know, really whatever. I got there, and I was like, oh, it's all a bunch of bureaucrats. The building sort of looked like high school. It was funny. I went into their little library. I checked out the building. I was thinking a little bit about like where I could drop a banner from and that sort of thing. But I was also there to sort of look up the rulemakings and see what I could find out about the possibility of them really actually legalizing low-power radio. It's a strange beast. It's very obscure. It's a very large organization, and they take their orders from Congress and from the executive branch. And so anything in Washington, there's what they say, and then there's like what they mean underneath what they say, and then underneath that, there's like what's really going on. And so it is very much like a nature show or something like that. You're watching the behavior of the species and trying to understand what they mean when they say this or that or the other thing. It's a weird hobby, but it definitely is interesting.
Pete's pirate radio station was called Radio Mutiny. It really all began for him as a tactic to get a community station in Philadelphia, which is still impossible. But more on that shortly. For now, a bit more about the early days of Prometheus.
It was formed in 1998, in the fall, right after we had had a pretty successful and entertaining demonstration in Washington, D.C., where we just where we built these giant puppets. We called it a meta puppet because it was a puppet controlling a puppet controlling a puppet. It was the giant broadcasters who were controlled by the giant corporations. There was like this 12-foot tall giant corporate tower. And then there was the big broadcasters, which was their puppet, which was a giant gorilla, like a 10-foot tall gorilla with a TV for a head. And then that gorilla in turn controlled a puppet, which was Chairman William Kennard dressed as Pinocchio. And every time he told a lie about pirate radio, his nose would grow. We called him Canardio. And we had just come off a pretty successful demonstration. We were very skeptical about the FCC, but we were just starting to believe that actually the FCC might change its rules. Just everything they said, they were really positive, and they were like, you know, we can't support pirate radio, but the truth is there's a lot of truth to what the pirates are saying about media consolidation of ownership. And if we can allow 100-watt radio stations as a partial remedy for some of that, we would like to do that. I don't know. That was not the reaction I was expecting to dressing up, you know, William Kennard as a puppet of the broadcasters. And there were many pirates that refused to have anything to do with the legalization process. But at some point, I realized that I actually did believe that they were serious. I didn't believe they would do everything that I was pushing for, but I realized that the idea had taken hold so much that even if I was against it, they would do some form of it. And so the train was moving, and we'd gotten some of what we had asked for, and was I going to be involved in it, or was I going to leave it to the religious right to take advantage of all the stations that were going to be given out? And so we made our choice, and we started focusing our work on legal, non-commercial 100-watt neighborhood radio licenses. We stopped doing active support of pirate radio. I mean, we still, in principle, I mean, if someone is a radio pirate in Philadelphia or anywhere else, they're right. I mean, the FCC did not change things, and they did not fix the system for a lot of people. But in the places where it's working out, we focus our work on low-power FM because we feel that starting legal stations is a very important historical opportunity.
So now you have low-power FM in the U.S. that has led to the rise of around 600 small stations across the country, and Prometheus that is supporting the development of such stations with progressive community organizations in a variety of locations. The radio barn raising in Florence saw several hundred radio people converge upon this small town to volunteer their time and skills. Which brings us to the important organizing work of Prometheus and Hannah Sassaman.
This is food for us. This is nourishment for the movement to know that every time a station goes on the air, it is worthy of celebration. And every time someone is taught a new skill of how to make their own media, it's like, it's one more step to having media that we can control and own, like during this oppressive era of imperial domination from the United States, and then after it's over. We need these skills. These are revolutionary skills that we are learning. This station went on the air, and it's reaching 20 miles away, and it's going to get even further, and they were receiving calls from all over the area, and it lit up so many more people even than touched that studio.
People forget how to self-manage. You know, most of the work they do in their life is run by a boss, and you know, in a station like this, there aren't bosses. Although there are certainly plenty of people that hold you accountable and maybe think of themselves as your boss. So I think that working in a community project like this helps to rebuild that sort of cooperative spirit that people need to have in order to be able to organize and change things. You know, people get into these, like, you know, kind of terrible behavior patterns where they're just like, they don't know how to share power. They don't know how to get people to buy into their ideas because they just want people to do what they want them to do, and they don't know how to listen necessarily. And working in a project like this, if you want to get things done in this kind of a context, you have to sort of socialize yourself a little bit and really think about, okay, well, I have this interest and this other person has this somewhat different interest. Is there like a place where we overlap enough to, well, where we can multiply our efforts by collaborating?
Prometheus knows a bit about community building. At times, they've had to build coalitions right across the political spectrum.
I mean, we've done all kinds of crazy things that we never would have thought we would have done. I mean, we work a lot with small Christian right radio stations. We don't build small Christian right radio stations, and we don't really encourage policies that particularly promote Christian radio stations. But the FCC's rules are content neutral, and I think that's good. I think it's good that the FCC doesn't differentiate between whether you're an anarchist or an Anabaptist, because probably we would lose anyway. And so in matters of common interest, like opening new filing windows and getting the FCC's rules to be more fair to the small entities, yeah, we work with Christian right groups, and we try to get them to get their ridiculously powerful senators and Congress people to vote for their interests. You know, that's some of the work that especially Hannah has done a lot on that. And we've tried to be always principled. We are always honest in that work. We are very deliberate about setting boundaries, like, no, I'm not going to come fix your radio station. That's your deal. We save our little bit of resources for the ones that we really want to see on the air. But when it comes to going before Congress, we work with them and share strategy with them. And I think it's good. I think it's good to stretch yourself beyond what you are used to.
I just look at someone and whatever they believe, like I really see the humanity in those people. I see their parents and I see their children and I see their drives home from work and their exhaustion and their joy. And I look at someone who has the wrong political beliefs, whatever the hell that means. Or I look at someone who believes something differently than I do and I don't care, you know? I see them and we want to help each other to survive as people in the world, and it's no one's fault really that they might not have consciousness. Like, I certainly don't have consciousness in many, many, many ways. And so when we can find an opportunity to work together collaboratively, we also have an opportunity to learn from each other, you know? I'm not going to ever go build a radio station with an anti-abortion station, right? I'm not ever going to build a barn raising with a station that just wants to be like a petty clear channel, like one that just wants to sound like a Hot 99, you know? I'm not going to do that. But I will defend, as long as I have to, within this political system, their right to their speech. And if they will work with me, I know we will both win.
Prometheus might seem small-time and cute, kicking off new radio stations with ragtag parades led by kazoo players and cardboard radio head things. But they don't take their work lightly.
Low Power FM is part of a long tradition of grassroots victories in media reform that have come from leaders working in anti-racist press, like in the 50s and 60s, and people who founded the Pacifica movement in the 30s and 40s. It's part of a real history in that way, and it's a real victory. It's a tangible one that we can really look at in the context of all the other policy decisions that have not just been made since the Telecom Act of 1996, which really heralded our era of consolidation, heralded the expansion of the Clear Channel Corporation from owning only 40 stations to owning almost 1,300, right? This is a victory that hasn't died. People expected this to fall down. They thought this was a piece of frippery. These are real radio stations, and the pulsing force they have in their communities is part of a long tradition of social justice change in both media reform and beyond.
I think that we're kind of the foot soldiers. There are lots of people in media reform that are more powerful than us, that have bigger mailing lists or whatever. But one thing that we do have is that we have a group of people that did petition the FCC and get a bunch of changes made. And so we have this almost hubris that makes us believe that if we step up and make demands and fight for them, we can win. There are so many progressive groups where there's a culture of loserism, where, you know, people are thinking, oh, this is too hard. They're like Eeyore or something like that. They're just, no, this will never work. And we're always going to be oppressed and nothing's ever going to work out in our way. And that's just our lot in life. And it's fine to be realistic, but we like to win. We like, at the end of a lot of work, we like to have the rules changed. And, you know, even if they're not exactly everything that we would want, we like to work, and at the end of the day, the station turns on, and we're very deliberate about that. And we're also deliberate when we create these barn raisings. We don't want them to have gone to another conference and just like learned how screwed up everything is and how overwhelming it all is and not have any solutions. We want them to walk away saying, maybe it's only 100 watts, but this is going to be here. It's not going to get kicked off next week, and this is going to be a real thing that's going to be around, that's going to be a great opportunity for people. And that's our organizing philosophy, is we do whatever we need to win. Winning is what makes it worth it.
And win they have. In 2005, Prometheus won their case against the Federal Communications Commission.
We sued the FCC. Okay, well, so the FCC has a responsibility and a mandate to regulate the media, meaning to determine who gets to own what and where, in the spirit and mission of making sure that the public interest is served, that communities can talk to each other. We, as the American people, grant licenses to corporations to use our media with an understanding that they will serve the public because of it. Now, this has fallen down like so badly ever since the FCC was established, but in 1996 it got even worse. Like, most of the restrictions that kept one company from owning everything in a town and everything across the nation were scrapped, and that scared a lot of people. But the FCC has traditionally acted behind closed doors. When the FCC asked for public comment, the largest comment window it had had up to that date was actually the low power FM window, which was about 4,000 comments. But that would never be enough to stop the FCC from deregulating media. And so Prometheus started organizing with a number of other grassroots organizations across the country to get people to send in comments saying, no, don't deregulate. Nope. Actually, no. Actually, that'll hurt my family. And so there were all these different comments that were going through. And when the FCC, and then this ricocheted, not just Prometheus, but many organizations ricocheted into getting millions of comments up to a deadline of June 2nd, when the FCC was listening to the American public in advance of its decision whether or not it would enact the rules it had proposed that would deregulate. The FCC voted 3-2 along party lines to deregulate without ever holding public hearings. They held one public hearing to talk about this issue only after great demand. And so we had ground, man. We had ground to go to the court and say, the FCC has not actually listened to the public it is supposed to represent. They have not read all of those comments. There is 99% of them were against the rules. Over 99% of them were against those rules. And so that gave us grounds to go to court. And we won that court case specifically because the FCC, like all of the different rules that it had put forward, the Third District Court of Appeals, which saw the case, said that the FCC had not actually justified its rules to the American public, hadn't actually given good arguments for why rules that deregulate media would serve the public interest.
Building on this success, they intend to go on to win before Congress shortly in order to improve access to licenses for community stations in major U.S. markets.
We are campaigning to try to get, we're trying to get low power FM expanded, man. It's just super not okay that the National Association of Broadcasters thinks that it has the right to go around pretending that there's interference from 100-watt stations to their 100,000-watt juggernauts. It's just, it's not only disgusting, it's idiotic. It's just not even a remotely plausible argument. And so the legislation that's forward right now, which is Senate Bill 312, that's 312, would, if it was passed, expand low-power FM into communities in which it is currently prohibited. Those communities being ones that have enough people living there and therefore are considered to be a lucrative enough media market by corporate radio stations that they have a crowded enough radio dial that the FCC will not allow licenses to be granted there. And so what we're doing is trying to get the FCC to roll back its restriction. The current restriction is on something called the third adjacent frequency, right? So if you have a station at 90.1 FM, a clear channel, smooth jazz station, the FCC currently must abide by rules that say you cannot grant a low-power FM within a certain minimum distance from that 90.1 smooth jazz clear channel station. You can't grant it, obviously, on the same channel, or the first adjacent channel, which would be 90.3, on the second adjacent channel, which would be 90.5. or on the third adjacent channel, which would be 90.7. That would mean that the FCC could only grant a license if there was room at 90.9 FM. 90.9 FM, that's such a huge buffer for that stupid-ass clear channel 90.1 station, right? We're trying to get that rolled back so there's no protection at the third adjacent. So communities living in cities like Phoenix, Arizona, or Minneapolis, Minnesota, or San Diego, California could potentially have a low-power FM station. That's what this bill is about. The reason now is a good time for it is because when Congress passed the law that restricted the low-power FM service, that made the FCC abide by engineering that it didn't even respect itself, Congress also mandated that the FCC would have to study whether or not there would actually be interference at the third adjacent frequency, the one I was describing before. So Congress said, hello, FCC, welcome to your new job, which is to study something. So they commissioned the MITRE Corporation, a defense contractor, very well-known and often used one, to determine whether or not there would be interference. And $2.2 million, and 3 years later, MITRE concluded that there was no potential interference at the third adjacent frequency. We knew that. They were supposed to not only study the engineering impact of low-power FM, but also the economic impact of any potential interference low-power FM would cause. And MITRE Corporation actually turned down money from the government, a defense contractor turning down money from the government, right? Saying there is no potential for interference. We are not interested in taking money to study the economic impact of zero interference, which would be zero, right? So that's what happened. And so MITRE went to the FCC and said, hello, we're done with that study you asked for, and there's no interference. And Congress and FCC said, okay, that's relatively awesome, and we're going to go to Congress and get them to change that law around. And now it's in Congress. So now is a really good time because there's 600 stations on the air. They're extremely diverse. There's conservative Christians, and there's radical farm workers, like all sharing the same airwaves, both of them standing on the same stage at the FCC, walking the halls of Congress, asking for their rights to their own airwaves, their rights to their lives, because it's in so many cases, having your own media is a life or death situation, right? So we're at a convergence of grassroots energy and policy opportunity and numbers that will hopefully win us the service that we deserve.
If Bill 312 passes, perhaps Pete will eventually be able to get a licensed station in Philly, although he doesn't have much time to spend there now that he's on the road, including overseas trips as Prometheus builds up its international projects. Aside from Bill 312, Prometheus keeps a close eye on other developments that might interfere with community radio and community-controlled media at large. Hannah gives this warning concerning some recent decisions made by the FCC this past summer.
Canada, you gotta really listen up, because what's going on right here right now is really bad. There have just, in the past 6 weeks, two different decisions have been made by the FCC that have now basically prevented competition on cable and competition in broadband. What does that mean? Why does that matter? If one company that owns, that laid most of the cable in your town or laid most of, like that drilled most of that cable for connectivity, if one company did that and they are no longer mandated to share those lines, right, to share those cable lines with competitors, they not only can jack up prices but also control content and control the structure of the internet. If they decide, if you're getting Comcast cable, right, and Comcast decides that they don't want you to download independent films that are critical of them, just as a start, they do not have to. They own those wires. They have no mandate to put forward diverse antagonistic content to your home. So this is the beginning of the degradation of the free system, which we understand as the internet. There's going to be censorship, and there's going to be a restructuring of something we've taken for granted, and we must rise up to protect the structure that has allowed independent media to grow so globally. Soon, the architecture that has allowed that to happen could degrade, and it could degrade globally, because the United States has a huge interest in ICANN, the group that distributes URLs, like addresses on the internet, has a huge interest in this actual structure of it. This is what's happening in the United States because media corporations have decided that their rights to innovate technology, to profit off of what belongs to the American people, are no longer, they can't be restrained. And we have this movement, and it's growing, and it's powerful, but we have to join together, and we have to find practical ways to work locally to win victories against our local media conglomerates, as well as we have to put aside those thoughts that we have when we think about lobbying and we think about Congress as something that's above us or under beneath us. Like, we have to actually go and do it or smash the state a little quicker, because like, we're in a situation where the freedoms of people who haven't yet been born are being decided under our noses.
For more information about Prometheus, check out www.prometheusradio.org. To tap into more great community radio, stay tuned for the next edition of Homebrew. Or to locate a community station near you, check out the webpage of the National Campus Community Radio Association at www.ncra.ca. To send feedback about Homebrew, email homebrew.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Jen Moore, in Guelph, Ontario, marching to the beat of the Florence, Massachusetts Revolutionary Drum Corps.